is a good software developer? What do excellent developers do? There are probably as many answers to these questions as developers in the world. So let's ask veterans and newcomers what their story looks like. Let's learn directly from them. Welcome to Developer's Journey. Hello and welcome to Developer's Journey, the podcast shining a light on developers' life from all over the world. My name is Tim Bourguignon, and today I receive Richard Roger. Hi, Richard. Thanks for joining.
Hey, Tim. How you doing?
Pretty good. Pretty good. You are a developer, an entrepreneur, a founder, a CTO, an author, I think active in the open source software communities and leading a community as well. And this is just the beginning of your bio, which I rewrote because it was too long. I think we have to hear it from you. So can you tell us which are the big milestones in your careers that led you to becoming such a broad developer, a broad T-shaped developer, maybe we can say, to develop such an expertise in many, many fields? Can you tell us just your developer's journey?
Sure. I would just add a little bit of explanation. The reason I do so many things is because I'm pretty bad at all of them. I think my one true skill is synthesis. Mm-hmm. So sometimes if you can bring different things together, you can create something new and interesting. My developer's journey starts in Africa, South Africa. So as a kid, I was completely obsessed with computers. So, you know, these old 80s TV shows from America, Knight Rider and the A-Team and all these things. I was a super big fan, but Knight Rider was my favorite because it had a artificial intelligence in the car. Mm-hmm. And I really wanted to program computers. And I grew up in a really small farming town in far north of South Africa. And I think there was like one computer in the whole town that did accounting for for like the local farmers cooperative or something. So my parents went to Johannesburg and they bought me a Spectrum 48K computer. And some of your listeners might be familiar with this, with the Spectrum. It had these kind of like rubbery squishy keys, and you plugged it into your TV and you could start programming BASIC. Mm-hmm. And I didn't have any games. All I had was the manual. and it kind of started from there. And, you know, it's a journey that kind of stops and starts. I eventually ended up in Ireland with that South Africa in the '80s. And I remember my grandmother bought me an Amiga 500, which is still the most awesome computer ever invented. and so in those days, there wasn't open source, so there wasn't a network. You know what I had to do? I spent, I think it was something like £90. Okay. So in euros today, that's probably like 200 euros or something, something crazy to buy an assembler, a commercial assembler. Mm-hmm. So I had the Kernighan and Ritchie, you know, the C programming language book, and I managed to get hold of a copy of that, but I couldn't afford a C compiler. So I had to buy an assembler instead. So I had to hand compile the C code into 6,000 to 8,000 machine language, and then make API calls into the Amiga's windowing system. that was pretty slow. It sounds more impressive than it was. Like I literally just got a window to open, and then you did very, very basic stuff. But that was still pretty cool. And then, you know, I kind of discovered, girls and rock and roll and stuff like that. I sold my computer to buy a stereo. I stopped coding for a long time until I went to university. And so I ended up, see, the reason I say that I'm not an expert at anything is I tried to do theoretical physics, but I wasn't intelligent enough for theoretical physics. So they wouldn't let me in. So I got a consolation prize, which was mathematics and philosophy. Which turned out to be really good because philosophy, you don't have to work. And mathematics is the mathematics department, had a whole load of really crazy, funky postgrad students who were Unix sysadmins who set up this really awesome network for everybody in the mathematics department. So we had like VT100 terminals, green screens. Mm-hmm. You went into the attic of the mathematics department, and these were like 24/7 terminal rooms where you could code with VI, right? So not Vim, VI, mm-hmm. original VI on like some really ancient version of BSD. So the introductory courses were always stuff like how to use the internet, like network news, that type of stuff. Gopher, remember Gopher? And how to code in C and C++ and Perl. So I did a lot of coding and not much mathematics. Really, not a lot of philosophy either. Although I can spell. The reason I can write is because of philosophy. So that's actually I would really recommend philosophy to anybody. That's a good subject. Mm-hmm. So in my final year in university, I failed probability theory, but I got 90% in C++. So average pass. And I was, I was all through university, I didn't know what to do, but I was getting these like summer jobs where I was like working in a warehouse. I'm going to try and say it correctly. Kärcher, the steam cleaning vacuum company.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I worked for them in Vienna for summer in their warehouse, underneath a steel tin roof. It was like 40 degrees. So it was just, and so after that summer, I was speaking to my friends in university, and one of them had got a job building websites. This is like 1996. And he was like, yeah, it's cool. You stay inside in an office, So I thought, okay, that's what I'm doing next summer. No way am I working in it. No way am I doing manual labor anymore. Mm-hmm. And it kind of took off from there. I managed to find out the email addresses of 40 companies in Dublin and Ireland that were building websites. And I wrote a little Perl script to spam all of them. With my resume. And I got 3 interviews and I got 1 job offer. And that kind of started from there. And of course, by the time I left in 97, I mean, things were going crazy. The first dot com boom was just taking off. All those silly ideas that seemed stupid at the time but are now like billion-dollar companies. Like in the course of that period of time, like I built a real estate marketplace. I built a taxi app, like all that stuff, right? Except it was like 15 years too early. They weren't my ideas, by the way. I mean, we were just like a consulting company. We just built stuff for people. We thought they were crazy, but we took their money. I went through this period of about 10 years of really intense software development in Perl and then Java. And I didn't really care about management or business or anything like that. I was just, because I didn't do computer science, I had everything to learn, but I was learning it while I was being paid. Mm-hmm. So I decided after a while that was kind of crazy. So I did another degree in computer science, as an evening degree. You can study in the evening. Mm-hmm. And then I finally learned proper stuff like, complexity analysis and this type of stuff. And a little bit more of the proper theory. My code got a little bit better. And I think, I'm not sure how it happened, but it was after the dot-com boom, after everything had gone kind of crazy, that I kind of got this interest in starting a company. So it's kind of an inverse relation. You know, you think before the dot-com boom, that's when you would want to start a company. But afterwards, after I sold the dead companies, that's kind of when I started. But I was sort of obsessed with this idea of being like an indie developer. So that's like where you have a website and you have some software product, and you make, you know, not crazy amounts of money, a small amount of money selling your software to people. Mm-hmm. You know, and then you don't have to have a boss and or project managers or any of those crazy people that make developers unhappy. And you can just build your own thing. But I was a really bad business person in my first company. I spent more time building a custom built from scratch. I wrote every line of code, e-commerce application, did everything, shopping cart payments, product pages, everything, built it myself. It's just crazy. I mean, you know, these days, you know, you focus on the product. You don't go build your own shopping cart.
That's true.
More time to build shopping cart and website than I did to build the actual product. But you know, that was my first business, and it kind of didn't work. And then I ended up working. So I now live in a small town called Waterford in the southeast of Ireland. It was founded by the Vikings. Mm-hmm. 11 years ago. It had the Institute of Technology here was one of the very first to teach computer science in Ireland. So it always had a really strong computer science faculty. And I ended up working in the research group there, coding, but also commercializing research. And that got me exposure to proper business people and proper business thinking, because in order to write research proposals, you have to justify the commercial side. Mm-hmm. Their whole job was to find startups or create startups from the technology that they were building. It was all telecom stuff. And I was involved with a startup there that was eventually bought by Red Hat. So that was really exciting. That was a fantastic experience. And I sort of decided then to try something again. Didn't have any idea what to do. But myself and a couple of other people, because we didn't really have any ideas, we just did a consulting company. Mm-hmm. And that was in 2011, just at the time that Node.js started becoming popular. And we decided to pick Node.js as our technology. And we were super, super lucky because Node.js took off and became really popular. Mm-hmm. Whatever your opinions about it, it became popular. And if you're a consulting company with a popular technology, then you have a successful business. And you can make all sorts of mistakes, which we did, but it lets you kind of cover for those mistakes. And that's how I got into microservices, which is my favorite software architecture now. Because if you've ever tried to build a large application in JavaScript, you will know that it's really hard. It gives you no structure. There's no object-oriented patterns that really work. It's a crazy, crazy language. And you just end up, if you write more than 2,000 lines of code in one file, you're in trouble. So you end up splitting it apart into microservices, because otherwise things end up crazy. So that's where I ended up using this architectural approach, I guess. And now I got tired of building software for other people and kind of wanted to go back to my own one and building my own software for my own company. So that's why I left that consulting company to start a proper sort of Silicon Valley style startup now, but also because I believe that the microservices approach would let me build stuff with a small team really, really fast. And that's kind of working, which is nice. So that takes us up to today.
Cool. Nice story. So you went to the you tried the India route and then took some detours and came back to the India route, actually.
Yeah. I had a lot of difficulty when I was younger working in large organizations and understanding political hierarchies and understanding the value of sales and marketing and the difficulties of coordinating large teams of people. I understand it all now because I had to figure it out and learn it to make money myself. But when you're a young developer, you can be very idealistic. Mm-hmm. You can be a bit of not a very nice person, I suppose. I mean, I didn't have lots of fights with people or anything, but I think a lot of project managers had a lot of stress because I wanted to make perfect software all the time, which is a bad idea. Perfect software is, if you're not producing software that has a measurable, repeatable level of errors, you're not actually making efficient use of resources. In one of my conference talks, I talk about this. So the space shuttle software is probably one of the most perfect pieces of software ever built. It cost something like $1,000 per line of code, and every release had like one bug. This is over like millions of lines of code. Fully documented and tested in multiple layers. And, you know, the capability maturity model comes from that software team. And I think we as software developers bring that mentality to loads and loads of inappropriate contexts, like building websites, where it doesn't have to be that good. You can have an acceptable error rate. But what's more important is to try and understand the business goals and how you can efficiently deliver the business goals, even if you do have errors. I think we forget the practicalities as developers sometimes.
How would you convince your younger self that this is the route to take?
I would have paid more attention in philosophy class. This is not a technical question. So one way that I developed an intuition for this idea was an addiction to Civilization. You know the computer game Civilization, which is about resource allocation. That's what running a business is, right? You have limited resources. You have to allocate them efficiently. And if you think about software development, the limited resources is your mental ability, right? The ability to hold the architecture all in your head at the same time, your basic mental energy levels, how much time you can actually spend coding. I mean, that's the problem with younger developers is they have so much mental energy. They can brute force solutions sometimes if they're good. But ultimately, it's a resource allocation problem. You only have so much mental capacity to build a complex thing that if you aren't careful about how you use it, you end up with projects that are late and over budget. And that, I think, would appeal to the scientific and philosophical side of my younger self, is just to connect those things together. As opposed to being, ideological about building software that had zero bugs.
It makes sense. It makes sense. I would like to jump to one thing you said, if I may. You mentioned during your introduction or your career, that you went back to evening university or take an evening degree, in computer sciences. Why did you have the feeling you needed this? Because you were running, or you were part of a running work, a running company. You were producing apps. You were kind of having a great start in your career, or so it sounds.
Yeah, and it's a good question, because some of the best software developers I've ever worked with taught themselves. Some of them didn't even finish high school. Mm-hmm. So it's not necessary to do formal education at all. One reason was I was embarrassed because although my average grade was a pass, it wasn't a very good pass. Because if you do mathematics, you have to work very hard. You have to study. You cannot memorize it. You cannot just do some work in the last week and then do the exam. Mm-hmm. You can do that in philosophy. it's easy to pass. It's very hard to fail. But in mathematics, it's very unforgiving. If you don't do the work, you don't do as well. And I was embarrassed that I didn't do a good job in that degree. And when you're young, you think you have loads of time, and I'll do another one and prove I could actually do well. I did. I got a first in the second one, but that's because of maturity more than ability. But I did feel that if I was going to make software my actual career, that I would need a proper qualification in it. I wouldn't think that now. I would completely disagree now. You've got to remember, if you grow up in Ireland in the 1980s, there's no jobs. The only possibility that you have to make your life better is education. And when you get that education, then you go to London or Germany or America or somewhere like that to earn a proper living, because there's no jobs in Ireland. And that all changed, but it's very hard to, it's like when a fish in the ocean can't see the water. It's very hard to think outside that necessity. Mm-hmm. You're stuck with a mental model that formal education gives you permission to code, perhaps. Mm-hmm. And I didn't see it at the time. But I was lucky, because that particular degree was focused on older people, and it wasn't just about computer science. They did a lot of business, and they did a lot of law as well, and they did a lot of project management. So I was lucky in the sense that it taught me a whole bunch of really useful skills to be more than just a junior developer. Just by accident, I ended up learning a lot of business skills from that course as well, which have been really, really useful to me over the years. Would I advise people to do it now? I don't know. There's so much resources now. I'm teaching my children to code, but the way that I'm doing it, especially with the younger ones, is there's like these apps. There's an app called Lightbot. You have this little robot that you can tell it to move left or right or forward, and you solve puzzles. It's really awesome. But then as you go through the app, you can start defining go-tos and loops and little functions. Mm-hmm. Really, really, really sweet little app. They can start developing intuitions about coding. And there's, loads of podcasts, for example, loads of YouTube videos, all that sort of thing. You can learn, you can teach yourself. So I don't know, the era perhaps of that level of formal education is perhaps not so important anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've taken part to heated discussions about should new should new developers learn binary at all, or is it something of the past already?
So here's the thing. It is useful. It's definitely useful. I think philosophically, and this comes from my sort of basic mental stance, which is synthesis, is you have to understand the basic level of everything. You have to be able to say, look at this MacBook Pro in front of you. explain to me how it works all the way up from the electrons to the GUI that you're looking at. I think at some level, as a professional software engineer, you have to be able to explain how all of those pieces fit together. I can't design an integrated circuit, but I understand the basic principles of logic gates. Mm-hmm. If someone put a gun to my head, I could probably figure out how to build an adder or something like that. All the way up to all those levels of abstraction around hardware drivers and the network and all those things. Even if you work at the surface level, I mean, I write JavaScript for a living, which is just so far removed from the physical reality of the machine. But even so, that understanding, it just helps you make the right decisions because you have the full context. Bit twiddling and binary logic is still something you have to do in JavaScript sometimes.
Mm-hmm. So let's stay in JavaScript maybe. If you had a new developer with you, some junior developer coming out of university that knows nothing, like we all know when you come from university, starting with JavaScript today, how would you go on and teaching how to write a proper application with JavaScript, since it's your cup of tea?
It's very challenging. So I had this exact situation in my company, and what I ended up doing was moving that junior engineer to Python and getting him to write microservices in Python. JavaScript is a bad language to start with. It has lots of kind of crazy concepts. There's all this, you get all this kind of power functional programming, but then you have this prototype based object model. And then you have all the, you know, the weird edge cases, which aren't edge cases. They're kind of by design. Python is really the place to start if you want to build somebody into being a good engineer. And it's not as bad a choice as it was, because the whole AI world is based on it now. When I wrote my book, I did a chapter on statistical analysis of microservices and their behavior. And I used Jupyter Notebook. It was fantastic. You know, everything just worked. It was wonderful. And you could produce lovely charts, diagrams. Mm-hmm. If you're using a microservices architecture, I have to say that really, don't I? Then you can have a polyglot approach and it doesn't really matter what things are written in. I mean, think about the craziness of modern front end development. It's insane.
It is.
It's completely insane. The frameworks keep changing all the time. The browser keeps changing. There's this hideous amounts of complexity. You have to learn three different languages that are based on different paradigms. You know, you have HTML tag soup, but HTML is hugely fault tolerant. You have CSS, which nobody really understands. And of course, you don't really use CSS because you have to use SAS if you want to build a large scale app. And then you have all these internet fights over people who talk about semantic CSS versus atomic CSS. And, you know, which one do you choose? Mm-hmm. There's probably going to be a new paradigm in 3 years' time. And then that's even before you start on JavaScript. And then people are telling you should be using TypeScript because that's proper engineering. And oh yeah, now you have to compile everything using Webpack and Babel. I started coding this stuff in 97, and I think it was JavaScript was just out then or the year before. Brendan and I did it in 96 or 97, I think. And it was static HTML, there's no CSS, and you wrote a Perl script, which had this incredibly simple model of here's a table of name value pairs, connect to a database, write some SQL, and then throw a result back. And if you want to get really fancy, you could use a template. And that was it. And I mean, it was easy to learn, and yet you could still build useful stuff. Now, I don't know. You sort of need to. I mean, of course, there are people who learn it, can teach themselves, and there's tons of resources. But if you're trying to take somebody and turn them into a software engineer, into somebody who can build large applications, with all this other craziness going on, it's really hard. I would say just use Python. It's much simpler to show somebody proper software design.
That's a good answer. And how would you go and going or ease somebody into the idea of microservices? I'm coming at this problem from a different angle. I'm mostly in agility, and I'm now facing a generation of developers who have never lived through a waterfall project. And so they are coming at this problem with a complete different angle. And I guess with microservices, that might be something similar. Students that are coming in and have the idea of microservices is completely obvious to them. Is it this way?
Yeah, that's a really interesting observation. Wow. Because I remember when Agile was revolutionary, right? So extreme programming, all that stuff. I mean, when I read that book, it was, oh my God, this is how we need to build software. The problem that we have is there is an idea of microservices as being just break everything down into small pieces that communicate on a network, and it's all just small web servers. Or, you know, you push it to its extreme, and there are nanoservices, you know, serverless architectures, which do have their advantages and benefits for sure. But I came to microservices from a very different direction, which was a search for a component model that worked. I didn't come at it from wanting to scale or anything like that. I came at it from the problem of trying to solve technical debt in large software systems. How do you stop early decisions about data schemas and data structures and, you know, relations between Java packages and object models and design patterns from slowly descending into chaos, right? So that inevitable entropy that builds up over time, how do you, it always will, it's inevitable, mm-hmm. but how do you at least control the pace, or how do you contain it and stop it from spreading throughout your application? So I was searching for a component model for a long time. And I was very fond of the command pattern, you know, where everything that happens in your application is a command. You know, you can effectively define it statically, and then your entire application is just an engine that runs commands. Because it gives you a very nice mental model, but it doesn't really solve the component problem. How do we get to Lego, where you can have pieces of software that have business logic in them that you can put together. So when I talk about a component model, what I don't mean is, you know, a component that can do XML parsing or send emails, or something like that, or a template engine, or is a database driver. That's not what I mean, you know, or a little utility function. A component, when you're building a real application, is something like, a user module that understands the business logic of users, that they can register, that they have password resets, that you can block them if they have too many failed login attempts. Mm-hmm. The business logic, or a shopping cart, which understands how to calculate sales tax. Or a discussion component, which understands how, a little discussion feature in your app might work, that people send each other messages, and, you know, some of them are public and some of them are DMs, this type of thing. Mm-hmm. That's business logic. And I want to be able to take a discussion component, plug it into my application, and a user component and plug it in. all of these different types of things so that I don't have to keep on redesigning entire architectures around these basic business logic ideas. And I want to stress this is different from, you know, an authentication component that knows that gives you an easy way to do OAuth with Twitter or whatever. This is the next level up. This is the next level of abstraction. Mm-hmm. And objects were supposed to do that, but they kind of failed. And I think they failed because their interface capabilities were too powerful. So if you think about how do you interface with an object, you can call methods, you can call static methods, you have object properties, you have static properties, you have inheritance, you might have mix-ins in some languages, there might be interfaces, proxies, factories, there's just all sorts of really complex ways of interfacing with an object. Mm-hmm. And compare that to a component model that is actually effective, which is the Unix command line, where the only interface is a stream of bytes. And you can create little bash scripts, you know, that pipe the bytes from one command to another and you grep them and whatever, right? That's a really effective component model. It's limited, of course, but you can actually do a lot with it if you try. But it's too simple. Mm-hmm. So I kind of experimented over the years with a number of implementations of the command pattern and kind of came to a point where I realized that if you did pattern matching on the commands, it would give you a component model, because the user component would expose a bunch of commands to do things like register a user and log them in and create a user, this type of thing. And those are the commands are effectively messages that you send to that component. And you can have a generic user component that, let's say you're building a HR management system. You can have a generic user component that understands how to log people in. But then you can write another special component that understands that when managers log in, they need to see a special management dashboard. Mm-hmm. And that component can intercept messages that it can look at the content of the message and say, okay, this user is of type manager, for example. And it's not really important how you establish that. It's just that there's some attribute of the message that's different. But if you think about what's happened there, I have a reusable generic component for users, and then I have extended it with a special case for managers, which is special case business logic for my company. But I didn't have to change the internal logic or data structures or code of the original component. Mm-hmm. And I plugged them together, but I also didn't have to really understand much about the interface of that component. All I had to do was get in the way of some of its messages and take them over. And that is enough in a lot of ways to build complex software systems. I know it doesn't sound like it's enough, but it's a component model where the interfaces are a bit more complicated than Unix byte streams, just a little bit more complicated, but much, much simpler than complex REST APIs or object interfaces or anything like that. Mm-hmm. The interface is just complicated. It just has enough complexity that you can encode different business rules. I built that first system that had that component model as a monolith. It had nothing to do with networking and separate deployment or any of the microservices stuff. But after, and I built it in JavaScript to manage the complexity we were seeing in the JavaScript applications we were building, because if I didn't deliver stuff on time, I didn't get to pay my salary and I didn't get to pay my mortgage. So it was a business necessity to come up with a faster way to build things. But then you can see how if the command pattern is just messages and essentially the messages are rooted to the right component, moving that to a network context is trivial, really. transport of a message, instead of it being a function call, an asynchronous function call, is now a network request. But the same basic model applies. And that has turned out to be super, super powerful. And that then dovetailed with the whole microservices movement. So for me, that's what microservices are. They are business logic components. It's irrelevant. It's irrelevant that they are small, separately deployable applications that you run with Kubernetes, and you have to have a service mesh and all sorts of all that other stuff. And all of that is completely irrelevant. People get so caught up with that side of it, but it's not what matters.
That's true. That's true. That's an interesting take on it. That's an angle I hadn't really pondered on until now. I need to think about this. And I guess this is the essence of all the way you are following on your book, the Tao of microservices.
Yeah. So I kind of go into the philosophy of that whole approach in the book. There's only one chapter that has code in it, which is the last chapter is kind of a case study of a search engine built with the microservice architecture. I mean, I guess there's two principles that really make that work. One is the pattern matching, which allows you to have this component model with the messages. And the other one is transport independence, which is really just saying you stop obsessing about whether it should be going through Kafka or HTTP or whether it should be synchronous or asynchronous or whatever. It doesn't really matter. A microservice, which is a component, sends a message. How it ends up at the other microservice doesn't matter. The infrastructure should look after that piece. It might just be a direct HTTP call, right? It might be a Kafka queue. It might be RabbitMQ. It might be Redis Pub Sub. It doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. And whether it's, you know, whether it's a worker pattern, whether multiple other microservices see the message or not, also irrelevant. You know, that's a configuration issue in your message routing. Now, some people turn around and they go, oh, enterprise service bus. You just reinvented an enterprise service bus. You're headed for disaster. But the difference is an enterprise service bus contained complex business logic. You could write code that ran in the bus to do routing. With this, you deliberately keep your routing ultra, ultra simple. It's just pattern matching and just powerful enough to provide that component model where you can intercept other messages and do different things with them.
Mm-hmm. Well, cool. I guess if the listeners want to listen to get more of that, I think your book should be the right place to start.
Yes, yeah. So, and it's somewhat sarcastic book. So I'm very impatient with enterprise software development.
Even better.
it's an angry book, I suppose you could say.
It's getting better with the minute. Cool. Sarcasm is running high in our industry, yes, I think.
Absolutely.
We're unfortunately reaching the end of our time box. Do you have any advice that you would summarize or give to the listeners? Somebody starting the journey and say, this is what I would like to give you on your journey.
Yes, you have to be very conscious and deliberate about the mental models that you're using to understand the world. So you remember I was talking earlier in the podcast about when I was younger, I hadn't developed very sophisticated mental models of the world. You can't just assume that you understand exactly how the world works. You actually have to seek out better models. You know, and a good place to start is understanding human psychological fallacies, right, or biases. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there's like basic stuff like anchoring, right? You know, so you walk into a supermarket to buy wine, and there's really, really cheap wine that you're not going to buy because it's probably vinegar, and there's really, really expensive wine that you're not going to buy either because it's outside your budget. But then in the middle is wine that's probably double the price, triple the price of the really cheap stuff, but still less than half the price of the really expensive stuff. And you look at that and you go, oh, that's reasonable. Mm-hmm. That's, you know, I'm going to buy the middle wine. But that's not an accident. That's completely deliberate. That pricing structure has been constructed to take advantage of your psychological biases, because you've been anchored to the really high price and you think the middle price is now a reasonable price. Or things like, I think it's called the availability fallacy, where, you know, you read a really cool article about some data structure and you just start using it in your code because it's in your head. As opposed to thinking, well, is this an appropriate structure for the problem that I'm trying to solve? There's a really great blog, actually. It's called the Farnham Street blog, F-A-R-N-A-M. And they have a whole list of all these, really cool mental models and, psychological biases. And all that. I mean, you know, if you want your project to be late and do no work for the next 2 weeks, it's a cool website to check out. They have a good podcast as well. So, you know, it's not just about, if you're in your 20s as a software developer, it's not just about raw intelligence and raw brain power. It's also about how you protect yourself from the weakness of the human brain, which is very, very weak. So that's the place. That's the right sort of approach to take. You know, if you don't have good mental models, you won't have good outcomes.
Amen. Thank you.
Well, thank you too, Tim. That was that was pretty very philosophical discussion.
It was
what I thought.
It's cool. Thank God you was not mathematical.
Yes, absolutely.
But philosophical, I can do. Before we call it a day, what's on your plate right now, and when? Where can people find you and start a discussion with you?
Yeah, so I'm doing a new startup called VoxGig.com, and I'm a conference speaker, and there's no proper online applications for conference speakers to help them manage their conference planning, that sort of stuff. So I decided to build one, and you know, it's all built using microservices. We do a whole bunch of open source. We open source about half the application. It's based on actually chapter 9 of my book, the underlying architecture. So I'm always happy to, talk about that side, but it's that component model that I spoke about. There is an open source project called SenecaJS.org that, implements it in JavaScript, but you could implement it in any language. Mm-hmm. So that's another good place. And Twitter as well, of course, RJRODGER, is a good place to annoy me if you have questions.
Cool. Then I think we have a show.
Wonderful.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure talking to you and recording your developer's journey. And dear listeners, we'll talk to each other in 2 weeks. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Listener, if you haven't subscribed yet, you can find this podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Music, and much more. And if you like what we do, please help your fellow developers discover the podcast by rating it and writing a comment on those platforms. Thanks again, and see you in 2 weeks.